Father, you have provided so much for us. You have blessed us beyond measure. You have provided a way to pay off the mortgage here and to redirect funds. We would first ask that you would give us wisdom in doing this. As the board meets, show us exactly what you want to do. Or if you don't answer, Lord, just help us to keep on praying, to seek you and for your direction where we should go. We thank you for this tremendous blessing, but we also thank you for your word, most of all, that you have given to us. You have placed your word above your name. It is so important. And I pray that we would understand, comprehend, and apprehend the truths that are there, that we'd be able to use it in our lives, not only for ourselves personally, but for those who are around us, to provide wisdom and direction when it is needed. When we call upon you, Lord, we know we have this promise that you'll give us wisdom whenever we ask for it. And so this morning, just teach us a little more. Fill us with your Spirit. Guide and direct us, for you are good, Lord, and every good and perfect gift comes from the Father of lights. And we praise you for that in Jesus' name. Amen. You know, when it comes to battling sin individually, it's difficult. It's something that we do on a daily basis, sometimes a moment by moment. And it's hard. It's hard to die to the flesh. Literally, we're supposed to crucify, well, metaphorically, crucify the flesh. We're supposed to subdue it. We're supposed to hold it down. We're supposed to take every thought captive that comes in. And we have that struggle individually. But when it comes to corporately or nationally, if the population is declining in a moral sense, it can even be more difficult to resist the tide of moral decay because it's the bandwagon. Everybody's doing it. And so we should go with the flow. We shouldn't go against the flow. And there is a struggle right now in our country to go with the flow. And as believers, we have to resist that. And I told you that after this election, we probably have a reprieve for a while in the forces of good and evil. If you just step back, you can almost see them raging back and forth, where evil wants to prevail, where this idea of ruining the next generation is coming upon us. Even when it comes to the birth rate in our country, it's down to 1.8, and I think it needs to be 2.3 to 2.4 to continue to grow. And in the blue states, it's down to about 1.4 because this ideology has come along where we don't want kids. We don't want to bring them up in this world, and there's climate change and they could die, and there's so much evil on the conservative side, and that which is good and moral and right is being changed into something else. And it's hard not to go along with that, especially when you see it in all the media. Well, this is what the Northern Kingdom of Israel was dealing with. Everybody started to go astray. The flow was just picking up speed, so to speak, like a river that's overflowing its banks. And people got caught up in that. And everybody just accepted the way it was supposed to be, worshiping the golden calves and the bulls. And that's what Jeroboam started. And it continued to the point where God just said, I've had enough. And so there are themes that are repeated in the book of Hosea, where we see the Israelites, they were bringing sacrifices to the Lord, but they were not bringing their hearts. It says in Hosea chapter 6, verse 6, for I desire mercy, not sacrifice, and acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. So they were faithful to bring these sacrifices not only to God, but to these foreign gods as well. They figured they would just cover all the bases so that we'd be safe. And our God, or they'd be safe, but our God is a jealous God, and he will not stand to have somebody else stand in his stead and receive the same worship that he receives. And these people would sacrifice to these foreign gods, and these foreign gods were real. We think that there is just something from a mythological standpoint, whether in Greece or Sumeria or wherever it might have been in the ancient world, but these were real entities, and people would sacrifice to them, and they would get a payoff. These entities, spiritual entities, which were placed over all the nations, they could bless or they could curse those people in the nation. And so they would start to instruct the Israelites when they came in, look, this is how we worship. You might as well follow it the way we do, because see the blessings that we receive? And God tested the people, tested how much they actually believed and followed Yahweh or Hashem. And he made sure that they were supposed to be faithful to do that. And when they weren't, they were punished for it. Because God was the one who supplied everything that they needed. He supplied the rain. He supplied the increase of the crops. He supplied the health. He supplied the peace on all sides. But they failed to recognize him. They wouldn't even acknowledge him. And they turned to these foreign gods. Then they were unrepentant idolaters and worshiping these false gods and that they had made with their own hands. In Hosea chapter 1 verse 2 and chapter 2 verse 2, he calls them adulterous through the imagery of Gomer. Remember, Hosea married Gomer, and because he named them the certain name, he said, not my people anymore. And he accused them of being idol worshipers, which translate into being an idolatrous people. They were interested in prospering themselves. It talks about having grain and new wine in chapter 7, which we will get to in verse 14. They build palaces in chapter 8 and verse 14. They were so concerned with their wealth and their well-being that they completely forgot about God. They refused to turn to the Lord for direction and guidance. God said that they had become arrogant. They were deceived, they were senseless, they were corrupt, they were wicked, and they were hostile to God. Kind of sounds like 2025 in this country. They have relied, or they did rely, on Egypt and Assyria for help and not on the Lord. They ended up paying money to Assyria to kind of protect them, and Egypt as well, and God detested that because they no longer were trusting in Yahweh for whatever they needed. They even, in their distress, when they would cry upon the Lord, or they would call upon the Lord and they would cry upon their beds, God just shut his ears. He said, no, judgment is coming because of what you have continued to do with your insolence. And the Lord wanted to bless Israel, but he could not, because they were so rude to God. Like I said, they were insolent. They would just turn away. They would ridicule. They would lie about who God was. And so God rejected them because they rejected the good. And from the kings and the priests to the people of Israel, they had all gone astray. Every one of them were going their own way. And we'll get in a moment to the book of Judges. And it says at the end of the book of Judges in chapter 21, everybody did what was right in their own eyes. They weren't looking to the Lord to trust him for what they needed and to receive his blessing because of this. Now, because of all these things that they had done, judgment was coming. Destruction was around the corner. God was going to punish Israel, and they were going to be the ridicule of all the nations. And when the final judgment actually came for them, they cried out, but God did not listen. Their crops, they would germinate, but they would not produce seed. Sacrifices would end up ceasing. God would take them away from the temple sacrifice. Of course, it was the northern kingdom. They had their own temple that they built up in the north, and the land would become desolate. It would be covered with briars and thorns where previously they would house gold and silver. God said, you guys are done. And then the women, he prophesied, would become barren. And even if they nurtured children, those children would end up dying and the parents would be bereaved and they were going to be scattered amongst all the nations. God was simply done with the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, this morning, I'm going to read through three chapters. We're going to take some leaps and bounds. We're not just going to stick on one or two verses, because God uses imagery and symbolism and colloquialisms, all of those types of speech he puts into the poetry here, idioms, and he wants us to kind of get the flavor of what was going on in Israel and how Israel could relate to the prophets and how the prophets would meet them where they were at or where they were. It's this idea, you have to know the culture that you're speaking to. Like for instance, with this idiom, if I said, abortion is a hot potato. Now, if that was in scripture, you could do all the searching you wanted to on hot, the word hot, and potato. And you could go through the whole Bible and look up every single reference. and you would not get the meaning of what a hot potato topic is. What is it? Something you cook on the stove? Is that what it is? And you see how idioms, they can have this hidden meaning, and if unless you're in the culture, you won't understand it. And there's a lot of that in here. And so we're going to go through this, beginning with Hosea chapter 7, verse 1. Whenever I would restore the fortunes of my people, whenever I would heal Israel, the sins of Ephraim are exposed. Now, as we go through this, when he talks about Ephraim, he's talking about the entire northern kingdom, because Ephraim was the biggest tribe in the northern kingdom. And the crimes of Samaria revealed. Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom. They practiced deceit, thieves break into houses, bandits rob in the streets. And so there was mayhem, like in our major cities that we have today. There's a lot of mayhem. I was listening to, maybe you know him, Victor Davis Hanson, just a wonderful scholar, Hoover Institution. If you want to gain some wisdom, just listen to him for a while and where the world is. And he said, you know, if we got rid of all the criminals that were allowed to come in the last administration, our crime rate would drop in half overnight. It's because we have all of these criminals that were taken out of prisons in foreign countries and dumped on our shores. But verse 2, they do not realize that I remembered all their evil deeds. Their sins engulf them. They are always before me. They delight the king with their wickedness, the princes with their lies. And so they would enamor the kings, the rulers. They would tell them things that they'd want to hear. They would lead the kings and their hearts astray down the road to sin. Corruption was in the entire nation, from the king on down to the lowliest citizen. In verse 4, here we have this imagery of a hot, fiery, burning oven. You guys ever gone to a restaurant where they have a pizza oven? And you walk by it and you go, whew, I can feel the heat coming out of there. Or I can remember taking a pottery class in college. And there was this thing that they would do called raku. And you would have to take your bowl or whatever it is you were making, and you would have to stick it in the furnace. You'd fire it up. It'd get to 3,000 degrees. And then what you had to do was open up the furnace when it was at its hottest. And you would have to take the bowl or whatever it was, you would pull it out, and on top of that you would throw leaves or you would throw straw or something like that, and it would burn up. And as soon as you opened that door, if you didn't have the protective gear on, your eyebrows would singe, your eyelashes were curled back in their head, and you would have a singed forehead because it's so hot. Well, that's the imagery that God is using here. He says, they are all adulterers, burning like an oven. Now, whenever you have like or as, that's a similitude or a simile. Whose fire? The baker need not stir from the kneading of the dough till it rises. In other words, he's trying to say, it is so hot that the baker doesn't need to get in there and throw some more wood in there and put the coals on top of each other and just mix things up to keep it burning. He goes, it's just hot all the time. On the day of the festival of our king, the princes become inflamed with wine, and he joins hands with the mockers. Their hearts are like an oven. They approach him with intrigue. Their passion smolders all night. In the morning, it blazes like the flaming fire. All of them are hot as an oven. They devour the rulers. All their kings fall, and none of them calls on me. Ephraim mixes with the nations. Ephraim is a flat cake not turned over. And so you get this imagery like a pizza oven. It is just baking hot. It's like that all the time, in the morning, in the afternoon. In Ephraim, or the northern kingdom of Israel, is like a piece of bread that's in there. What happens if you put a piece of bread in an oven, and the type that they would have is like a pita bread? If you put it in there and don't turn it over, what happens? It just gets torched on the top. It becomes ruined. And that's what he's saying here. Now, I don't know how many of you cook your own bread, but this is the imagery that they would have understood completely. Us, we go and get some Wonder Bread, if you like the white bread, or you get the whole grain bread, whatever it is. We don't have to bake that stuff anymore. But they would completely understand what he's talking about here. Like, wow, the oven's hot, and this is not a good thing. So the Israelites were inflamed with lust, desire, hatred, rebelliousness, and it never calmed. It was always at a fever pitch. Now, foreigners, verse 9, sap his strength, but he does not realize it. His hair is sprinkled with gray, but he does not notice it. Now, we have mirrors, right? They didn't have mirrors back then. And what do you know if your hair is turning gray? You're getting older, right? You look in the mirror and you go, oh, those roots right there, or is there any hair left? You know, and you're kind of examining what's going on. But Ephraim is being told, or Israel is being told, you were aging out, you were getting weak, you're going to decay, and your life is basically going downhill. That's what he's telling him here when he says his hair is sprinkled with gray and he does not notice. He doesn't even realize he's becoming weak. When I say he, it's the northern kingdom of Israel. And so God is spelling this out through the prophet Hosea. And of course, that's an idiom. That's one of the idioms that's used there. Verse 10, Israel's arrogance testifies against him. But despite all this, he does not return to the Lord his God or search for him. Ephraim is like a dove, easily deceived and senseless. Now calling to Egypt, now turning to Assyria. When they go, I will throw my net over them. I will put them down like birds of the air. When I hear them flocking together, I will catch them. Now, in our backyard where we live, we've had all kinds of birds. It's up on a hill a little bit, and we have this wrought iron fence in the back, and birds like to perch there because right it just goes down. And so we've had the red-tailed hawks, especially the infants. They'll go right on the corner of that fence right there, wrought iron fence, and they'll just kind of look over, just kind of check things out. And we can see them from our back door, and we look out and go, oh, there they are out there. Well, we've had crows, and we have turtle doves. We have the doves that are out there, and they just sit there and coo. It's a perfect perch because it looks out, and it just drops. And so they like to sit there. And these birds, the doves, they're so innocent. You can hear them, ooh, 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 out there just singing away, so to speak. And, of course, the red-tailed hawks, they do that as well. But they are so innocent. Now, a little diving illustration here. I've been to Catalina Island diving, and they have a lot of kelp there. And in the kelp, it's like a kelp forest. When you go down, it's a fascinating thing. You go down to the bottom, and you look up, and the kelp is just rising like cedar trees all around you. And you have to be careful because you can get hung up in it a little bit. But inside of that kelp are 200-pound, 300-pound black sea bass. Now, I don't know if you know how big that is, but it's bigger than me. It is just a massive fish, and they are protected because they are so docile. They are so innocent. You could actually go right up to them, and you could touch them, and if you touch them, they would probably say, "Don't touch me," and they would just move to the side a little bit. That's the type of fish that they are, and they are just monster size. But Israel was like that, innocent. They don't even know what's going on. And that's why the black sea bass are protected, because they were being wiped out. I remember as a kid, a dentist, he had shot one and brought it to his house. And it was such a big thing that we showed up and all went in and looked at it. And the eyeball was like this big. And we're going, oh, that thing is a monster. Well, being innocent like that, whether it's the doves or whether it's the black sea bass, Israel was falling into the same trap. They didn't even know what was going on. They had totally lost their bearings, their direction on what was right and what was wrong and who Yahweh was and who these other gods were. So God ends up, again, condemning them and talking about them. Now, let's go on. What verse did I end with? 12? When they go, I will throw my net over them. I will pull them down like the birds. And of course, birds, sparrows. You see the sparrows flying around? They're just as innocent as can be. And you could put up a net and they would be caught in that net. And the Lord's going to catch Israel and judge them the same way. Then verse 13, woe to them because they have strayed from me, destruction to them because they have rebelled against me. I long to redeem them, but they speak lies against me. They do not cry out to me from their hearts, but wail upon their beds. They gather together for grain and new wine, but turn away from me. In other words, the abundance that the Lord has provided for them, they don't recognize God for giving it to them. I train them and strengthen them, but they plot evil against me. They do not turn to the Most High. They are like a faulty bow. You guys ever done archery? You know, and it's kind of fun, but imagine being in the midst of a battle and the enemy is coming upon you. And you take your longbow and you get ready to string that thing or put the arrow in there, pull it back, and it goes snap. It just breaks in two. And here comes the enemy. That's what he's talking about here. Now, none of us go out hunting with a bow. Maybe you've gone hunting for elk or deer with a bow hunting. I know some people who have done that and they're real successful at it. But for the most part, we don't do that. That's what they did back then. And they would understand this idea of a faulty bow, this metaphor that's being used here. Their leaders will fall by the sword because of their insolent or rude words. For this, they will be ridiculed in the land of Egypt. In other words, once again, Egypt, it is reminiscent of slavery. So when you see Egypt mentioned here, he goes, you are going to go to places like Egypt and you're going to become slaves. Judgment is coming. Now, Hosea chapter 8, verse 1. Put the trumpet to your lips. An eagle is over the house of the Lord. And I think eagle is probably not a good word here. It's more a large bird of prey. Have you seen the large eagles over in Mongolia that they use to hunt sheep? Have you seen that? These things are massive eagles. And there will be the sheep or rams that are on the crags, the steep cliffs. And these guys will send these eagles up. And they're so big, they can grab a sheep. They pick it up. And they soar high, and then they drop it. And that's what they use to hunt with. If you've never seen it, you got to look it up. And that's what God is saying. There is a large bird of prey over you. Now, if you went back to prehistoric times, and what are they, pterodactyls or something like that, they would come. They would be massive. They could pick you up and eat you like a worm. They were so big. And he's saying, there is this eagle over the nation, and it's just looking at you, and you are done for. This is the judgment that God is talking about here. It says, an eagle, which is a large bird of prey, is over the house of the Lord because the people have broken my covenant and rebelled against my law. Israel cries out to me, O God, we acknowledge you, but Israel has rejected what is good, and enemy will pursue him. It goes on, they set up kings without my consent. They choose princes without my approval. And so this metaphor of this eagle or this bird of prey coming over, for us, something that maybe we can relate to a little more. Maybe you've been in the Midwest where a storm is rolling in. I remember once we were in Houston. We were doing some relief in Houston. And we walked outside the house we were staying in, and there was this cloud. And it looks like this cloud was 1,000 feet tall, and it was rolling in like a roller pin. And we watched it. You could see it just roll in, and it was coming right for us. And I took some pictures at the time, go, look at that thing. It's just massive. And underneath it was just black. It was so dense that the light couldn't get through it. Have you ever been under a cumulus nimbus cloud that has, it's a big thunder clapper that's just massive, and you get underneath it and it's just as dark as night. And then the wind starts blowing and the hail starts coming down and maybe even twisters form. That's the imagery that he's portraying with this eagle that is here. If you've never been in a storm like that, or I used to live down in Palm Desert when I was younger, and the storms would come over the mountains, and there would be a lightning strike like every second. And I would go on the roof and just watch it. And I would just go, oh, look at that storm. It's just amazing. Of course, I was far enough away from the hill. Sarah, you remember those, right? You were down there at that time. And it would just be an incredible storm. If you haven't been in that, type of environment, it's something to behold. And that's what he was telling the Israelites. This is coming your way. Now going on, back to verse 4. And they set up kings without my consent. They choose princes without my approval. With their silver and gold, they make idols for themselves to their own destruction. Throw out your calf idol, O Samaria. My anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of purity? To be holy was not even on their radar. That's why God says, how long will they be incapable of purity? And he talks about them being set apart for God. And that's for us as well. We're to have a mindset. We're to be set apart for God. We're to be holy. We're not to go the direction of the world, whether the media or the politicians or whoever it might be, education, they lead in that direction. We're to resist that. Going on in verse 6, you see the exclamation point? Do you have it on the text there? The exclamation point on verse 6? Show verse 6. Is that it? Yeah. See the exclamation point? Let me put this in context. Verse 5 says, throw out your calf idols, O Samaria. My anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of purity? They are from Israel. In other words, they should know what's going on here. They're Israelites. They have Yahweh. They have the miracles of Moses. All of that. Have they forgotten who they are? They are the chosen people of Yahweh. How could this be? Don't they remember all the miracles God performed for them in the past? What on earth has happened to them? That's what's being described here. That's what Hosea is saying. This calf, a craftsman has made it. It is not God. It will be broken in pieces. That calf of Samaria, they sow the wind and reap the whirlwind. Now, this is an agrarian society, so they can understand this. We ourselves, not so much. If you have a garden, you know, and you cultivate that garden, that's nice. But imagine this. All the fruit trees we have now, they are all grafted. If you took like a citrus seed, a lemon, or an orange seed, and you tried to plant it, and that came up, it would be a wild bush. And so what they do is they take that type of rootstock and they take a good producing stock, they cut that and they graft it into that good rootstock, and then they cut off the rootstock that comes up from that. If you notice all fruit trees, especially citrus, you'll see this hump at the bottom of the trunk, and that's where they grafted in the new graft. When that takes off, if you were able to plant a seed, how many lemons, if you had a lemon tree, do you think that you could receive over the rest of your life? Hundreds from one seed. Hundreds would be available to you. They sow the wind and reap the whirlwind. This is kind of a idiom or a symbolism to depict sin. You sow one seed, and how much does it produce? Look at a grain of wheat. One grain of wheat falls, you might get 30 more kernels, 60 more kernels, 100 more kernels on the end of the tip of the wheat. Same thing with any type of fruit tree. You plant one seed if the tree was able to use that seed, but it would produce hundreds of pieces of fruit over its lifetime. God is saying the same thing here. Israel, they have been sowing these seeds and sowing a lot of them, and now all of a sudden they're praying for crop failure because they don't want the sin to take off. That's the whirlwind. That's what he's describing here. Going on, one more time in verse 7, they sow the wind and reap the whirlwind. The stalk had no head. It will produce no flower. Were it to yield grain, foreigners would swallow it up. Israel is swallowed up. Now she is among the nations like a worthless thing. And they have gone up to Assyria like a wild donkey wandering alone. And he's just saying this is now a nation without direction. Ephraim has sold herself to lovers. And that's probably referring to not only the idol worship, but them giving allegiance to the nation of Assyria. Verse 10, although they have sold themselves among the nations, I now gather them together. They will begin to waste away under the oppression of the mighty king. Though Ephraim built many altars for sin offerings, they have become altars for sinning. I wrote for them the many things of my law, but they regarded them as something alien. They offer sacrifices given to me. They eat the meat, but the Lord is not pleased with them. Now he will remember their wickedness and punish their sins. They will return to Egypt, which means slavery. Israel has forgotten his maker and built places. Judah has fortified many towns, but I will send fire upon their cities that will consume their fortresses. In other words, they were prosperous. They had these towns that were fortified. They had these fortresses, so to speak. They were bringing their sacrifices to Yahweh and the other gods. They thought everything was just going fine. It was okay to worship the foreign gods and worship Yahweh. And it's not true. God is a jealous God. He will not have it. Going on in chapter 9. Do not rejoice, O Israel. Do not be jubilant like the other nations, for you have been unfaithful to your God. You love the wages of a prostitute at every threshing floor. He's referring to their idolatry, offering these sacrifices that were probably offered on places that were originally meant for Yahweh, but they have turned it into the worship of other gods. Threshing floors and wine presses will not feed the people. The new wine will fail them. They will not remain in the Lord's land. Ephraim will return to Egypt, again, that's slavery, and eat unclean food in Assyria. They will not pour out wine offerings to the Lord, nor will their sacrifices please him. Such sacrifices will be to them like the bread of mourners. All who eat them will be unclean. This food will be for themselves. It will not come to the temple of the Lord. What will you do on the day of your appointed feast, on the festival days of the Lord? In other words, you're not going to celebrate those festivals anymore in the land of Israel. Even if they escape from destruction, Egypt will gather them and Memphis will bury them. Their treasures of silver will be taken over by briars. Their thorns will overrun their tents. In other words, desolation is meant for the land. And poverty is on the horizon. Verse 7, the days of punishment are coming, the days of reckoning are at hand. Let Israel know this, because their sins are so many and your hostility so great, the prophet is considered a fool, the inspired man a maniac. So those that would carry the wisdom of God, they are shunned. Now, is that done today in our society? It is. Those who stand for righteousness, those who would have the Judeo-Christian ethic, they are ridiculed. They are called, they're antiquated. They're something from a bygone age, and we need to be more progressive. That is what our society is saying even now. It goes on, I'm going to go back to verse 7. The days of punishment are coming. The days of reckoning are at hand. Let Israel know this, because your sins are so many and your hostility is so great. The prophet is considered a fool, the inspired man a maniac. The prophet, along with my God, is a watchman over Ephraim. Yet snares await him on all his paths and hostility in the house of his God. They have sunk deep into the corruption as in the days of Gibeah. Now, when you see something like this, you have to go back and you have to ask the question, what is Gibeah? What took place in Gibeah? Now, to make a long story longer, I'm going to tell you what happened in Gibeah. It starts out in Judges chapter 19. In Judges chapter 19, you have this Levite. He lives in the hill country of Ephraim. And he has this wife, and this wife comes from Bethlehem in Judea, which is in the southern portion of the southern kingdom. And so he takes this wife, but she becomes unfaithful to him. So what does she do? She goes back to her father in Bethlehem of Judea. So the Levite, he goes, you know, I'm kind of lonely. I think I want her back. So he goes down to this woman's father, which the scripture says it's his concubine, but it calls the man his father-in-law, which means a concubine was his wife, but of a lower standing. So if I say concubine or wife, it's kind of interchangeable. So he goes down there and the father-in-law receives him and says, so happy you're here. Let's sit down and have a meal. And so every day for the next 5 days, this Levite is getting ready to leave. And then the father-in-law says, no, stay and have another meal. Sit down. It's almost dusk, you know, just sit with me again. So he does this for 5 days in a row. And at the fifth day, what happens is the Levite says, no, I'm not going to stay anymore. We're going to leave. So he leaves in the afternoon and he starts heading back north from Bethlehem towards Jerusalem. And he has a servant with him, two donkeys, and his concubine or his wife. And the servant turns to the Levite and he says, hey, let's go ahead and go to this city here called Jebu. And if you look it up, Jebu is where the Jebusites were from. The Jebusites, the city that they occupied, Jebu, is Jerusalem. Adonai Zedek was the king of Jerusalem at that time. This is after Melchizedek. Adonai Zedek, the Lord is God, is the name of this guy, but Melchizedek was also the king of Salem, the king of peace, the king of Jerusalem. So there's some history that is involved there. And the Jebusites were actually coming from the Amorites, which were coming from the line of Noah through the son of Ham and through the son of Canaan. Canaan was cursed. These people were a thorn in the side of the Israelites. Now, another person that you know of who was a Jebusite was Araunah. Araunah was the one that David went to, wanted to buy the threshing floor because of his sin, and he wanted to sacrifice to God, and that is the area of the Temple Mount today. That is what is going on there. And there are several things about that area. It's kind of interesting to do the background check on it. But anyhow, the servant says, let's go to that city. And the Levite says, no, I don't want to go to that city. That's a wicked, alien, strange city. Why? Because they would sacrifice their children in that particular city, in Jerusalem at that time. And so he goes, no, let's go on to Gibeah, the area of Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin. And so they went there and they arrived there right at dusk, right in the evening. And there was a guy there who was also from the hill country of Ephraim. And he's coming in from a field that he owns in that particular city in Gibeah. And he comes back into the square in the city and he sees this Levite there with his servant, the two donkeys, and his concubine. And he goes, what are you doing out here? He goes, well, nobody has put us up yet. And we're out here all alone. He goes, you must not spend the night in the city square. You're going to come to my house. And so he brings him to his house. The man who invited him in, he provides food for him. The Levite said, you know, I have bread and I have wine. I have fodder for the animals. We don't need anything at all. But the man who took him in said, no, I'm going to take care of all of that. He fed him. He fed the donkeys. And all of a sudden there was a knock on the door. Who was that? It was the men of the city, the Benjamites. They wanted to sleep with the Levite. They wanted to sexually abuse him. Does this story sound familiar? You know, remember Lot and all of that? Well, the owner of the house said, no, this ought not to be. He says, I have a virgin daughter and he has this concubine. You can have them. What a couple of good men they are, huh? And so what happens is the Levite grabs his concubine, throws her out the door for the men to have their way with her. They rape her all night long. She is spent at the end. It says they abused her as well. She is spent, and the next morning she crawls back to the house, and her hands rest on the threshold, and then the Levite comes out, and he goes, get up. She doesn't respond. She's dead. She had been so abused that she died. The Levite, he takes his concubine, goes back to his city, takes his concubine, his wife's body, cuts it up into 12 pieces. Is this not a movie? I mean, you could make this into a movie. Anyhow, he cuts up her body, 12 pieces, and sends it from Dan to Beersheba in the south. Beersheba is the lower point of the southern kingdom of Judah, all the way to Dan, which is the northern point. And the people in Israel, and this is before the divided kingdom, okay? And the people in Israel, they're just up in arms. This is the time of the judges. This is before the king, King Saul. And so what happens is the Israelites, all 12 tribes are up in arms. Who would do such a thing? And what happens is, once he does this, in Judges chapter 19, verse 19, it says, we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for ourselves, your servants, me, your maidservants, and the young men with us. We don't need anything. And so that's when he went to the house. And then Judges 19, 22, while they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city, and they were Benjamites, surrounded the house, pounding at the door. They shouted to the old man who owned the house, bring out the man who came to your house so we can have sex with him. Then Judges 19, 25, but the man would not listen to him, so the man took his concubine and sent her outside to them. They raped her and abused her throughout the night, and at dawn they let her go. At daybreak, the woman went back to the house where her master was staying. She fell down at the door and lay there until daylight. In Judges 19:30, everyone who saw it said, "Such a thing has never been done, not since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt." Think about it. Consider it. Tell us what to do. So that's after he carved up her body and sent it to Israel. So the Israelites are saying, this is just pure wickedness. So what happens after this? And by the way, this is the city of Gibeah. Now, Gibeah is one of the cities of the tribe of Benjamin. There are several cities in that area. And this is where the Benjamites came out of. Now, what happened was the Israelites got together 400,000 swordsmen. 400,000. And they all meet. I think it's at Gilgal. Gilgal or Mizpah. They get together. They're all there. What are we going to do? They say, we're going to go get those Benjamites and we're going to take care of them. And so what happened? The Benjamites got together 26,000 soldiers, and they had 700 soldiers from the town of Gibeah, and they were able to use a sling and hit a hare and not miss. Now, have you guys ever seen, we just watched The House of David. I think it's a pretty good show. There's often some stuff, you know, like the King David doesn't have red hair. You know, he's a handsome looking man. This guy's not so handsome. He's not red haired. Anyhow, that's my little criticism of it. But he was able to use a sling and he kills Goliath. And when you're watching, you go, whoa, you know, and that stone, he had to throw it and had to lodge in Goliath's head. Now, this first video I'm going to show you is a guy taking a sling. And if you turn up the volume and you listen carefully.
This is why slingshots were so feared back in the day.
Did you hear that secondary sound? Do it one more time.
This is why slingshots were so feared back in the day.
Could you imagine being hit by that rock? They say that that rock, in this video, I don't know if they added to it or not, but they say the rock broke the sound barrier, and that's the second crack that you hear. Show the next one. How accurate can you be? Same guy. Would you like to be hit with one of those? 700 guys, Benjamites, the ones who committed the sin, they were going to go against the Israelites. And what happened? The Israelites lost in the first wave. They lost on the second wave. They lost about 22,000 men in the first phase. Israel lost 18,000 in the second phase. And this is going against the Benjamites. The third wave, the Lord gave them into their hands. The Benjamites were almost utterly wiped out. There was only 600 that left to survive, and they hid in the hills for 4 months. Because of this, the entire tribe of Benjamin was threatened. It was going to be taken away. And you can go and read the rest of the story, what they did to get wives for these guys, and how they took an oath that no man would ever give his son to a wife of a Benjamite. And it's an interesting story. Excuse me. But the wickedness that took place in Gibeah, how these guys raped this woman and killed her, they were judged for it. And that's what God is referring to when he says, remember Gibeah and what happened there? Now, going on, God will remember their wickedness and punish them for their sins. When I found Israel, it was like finding grapes in the desert. When I saw your fathers, it was like seeing the early fruit on a fig tree, which means they were a blessing. But when they came to Baal Peor, they consecrated themselves to that shameful idol and became as vile as the thing they loved. Ephraim's glory will fly away like a bird, no pregnancy, no conception. Even if they rear children, I will bereave them of every one. Woe to them when I turn away from them. I have seen Ephraim like Tyre planted in a pleasant place, but Ephraim will bring out their children to the slayer. Give them, O Lord, what will you give them? Give them wombs that miscarry and breasts that are dry, because all their wickedness in Gilgal, I hated them there. Gilgal. Okay, what happened in Gilgal? Well, Gilgal was a place that the Israelites crossed the Jordan River, and that's where they camped. That's where the first Passover was. That's where the men were circumcised. It was a place where King Saul was anointed as king. It was also the place that Samuel condemned Saul for what he had done, holding back the slaughter. I think it was the Amorites. He kept some stuff from that. And Samuel shows up and says, what do I hear? The bleating of the sheep here. And so he was condemned for that. The kingdom was told to be ripped out of his hands at that point. But that was a special city. It was one of the cities that Samuel would sacrifice in, one of three cities. And what happened is they ended up turning to idolatry as well in that city. And so God condemned them. He says, because of their sinful deeds, I will drive them out of my house. I will no longer love them. All their leaders are rebellious. Ephraim is blighted. Their root is withered. They yield no fruit. Even if they bear children, I will slay their cherished offspring. My God will reject them because they have not obeyed him. They will be wanderers among the nations. What a story that has taken place here, how God is so vividly displaying what has taken place and how they have fallen and the idolatry they got involved in. Now, apply this to us. I started out by saying they were unrepentant idolaters worshiping false gods they had made with their own hands. Do as a country. Now, you guys are the church. You are the sheep of his pasture. I'm not beating up on you. I'm not supposed to beat the sheep. I'm looking at our nation, okay? You guys are here. You're going, hey, we worship God. We worship Jesus Christ, and that's all good. But keep in mind, we live in a nation that doesn't see things the way that we do. Do we craft our own idols with wealth and power and sex and prestige in this country? Us and Self magazines. You remember what a magazine is? They used to pass those things out. You could buy them, right? We were interested in prospering ourselves. Everything is about getting ahead. You know, the influencers that are out there on the internet. Oh, you can have this if you just follow me. They refuse to turn to the Lord for direction and guidance. I think we did that in the last election. I think God turned things around for us because as a nation, we are fairly repentant. They have relied on Egypt and Assyria for their help, not the Lord. Do we rely on the other nations around the world? Have we been doing that? Who does all of our production, all our manufacturing? It's not us. It's China. We're relying on them. And now there's a battle going on with that. We don't know how that's going to turn out, but I'm hopeful. Even in their distress, when they cry upon their beds, they did not turn to God for help. Do we turn for God in the time of our distress? I think we have. And if we continue to do so, God will continue to bless because that's what he wants to do. That's what he wanted to do with Israel. And from the kings to the priests to the people of Israel, they have all gone astray. Our presidents, our congressmen, our judiciary, our governors, our mayors, our local school boards. It is infected with people who are bent on sinning. And so what should we do? What God encouraged Israel to do. We turn to God and we say, God, we are so sorry for who we are. So what do we do personally? Remember that Israel is on the path of righteousness and fell into idolatry. We could easily have that happen to us. Pray to the Lord for wisdom to be more fervent for the Lord than ever before. We should speak out when we see evil and corruption. We can say, this is right and this is wrong. Point out what is good, just, and fair. And do not be afraid to stand for Christ. Remember remember who he is and acknowledge him. Don't be afraid to do that with your family, friends, and even strangers. Now, what we're going to do at this point, since we follow Jesus Christ and we do this every month, we are going to remember him in receiving the elements of communion. If you guys would like to come up, Kim. And Kim will start playing a song. And what will happen is Kim is going to start playing. And as she plays the song, we're going to wait about a stanza or so, and then the guys are going to come forward. They're going to pick up the cup and the bread, and they're going to pass it out. And then once we're finished passing it out, we are going to participate in receiving the elements together. But I want to make sure that when you get that, just hold on to it so we can participate as a body in recognizing the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ.